disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, March 23rd, 2021. On today's show, we start off with an action roundup from ongoing resistance to the Line 3 pipeline, continued battles on the streets with the state, to the growing struggle for housing, and much more. We then switch to our discussion, where we tackle the need for peer-to-peer support, both in our movements and our daily lives. There's a lot to cover, so let's dive right into it. The Biden administration is currently expanding the number of camps to hold migrant children and their families. As one report recently wrote, the Biden administration officials confirmed that they are expanding the number of camps to hold the influx of migrants, including a convention center in Dallas that will be used to imprison children. Another camp in Midland, Texas is also being utilized. The White House is desperate to cover up a swell of migrants coming from the U.S.-Mexico border, the overwhelming majority of whom are escaping extreme violence and poverty in Central America. The worsening conditions in the camps have proven to be a political embarrassment for the Biden government, which was voted into power with the promise to reverse the anti-immigrant policies enforced by Trump. Adding insult to injury, newly leaked photos show the conditions inside migrant detention camps amidst the COVID-19 pandemic remain just as bad under Biden as they were under Trump. Although the Biden administration ended one particular egregious practice, separating parents from children and detaining them in separate facilities, it is keeping families united by expelling them across the border, denying their rights to file asylum claims once they reach U.S. soil. In response to political attacks from Republicans demanding even more cruel treatment to immigrants, Biden sends envoys to Mexico and Guatemala last week to ask officials to assist them in blocking migrants from reaching the border. The Mexican government has already increased its presence of law enforcement at its southern border under pressure from the Trump administration. Mexico has been engaged in its own deportations, which it calls assisted returns. Immigrants in migration stations face abhorrent conditions and attacks from brutal police. Biden's promises of reversing Trump's asylum policies have proven to be lies, as his administration has continued to arrest, detain, and deport migrants in large numbers. More than 100,000 people were detained by immigration officials in February alone. This includes over 9,000 unaccompanied minors, a more than 60% increase from January. Meanwhile, people across Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince and beyond continue to riot as a massive uprising sweeps the country in opposition to the U.S.-backed Haitian president, who is tied to widespread kidnappings, authoritarian violence, and massive corruption. Vice reports that in the last 2 years, at least 180 people have been killed by security forces during riotous demonstrations against the regime. Actions against the Line 3 pipeline continue across the so-called United States as part of a week of action aimed at stopping the construction of the project. If you're looking for on-the-ground reports and action updates, Resist Line 3 on Twitter has been doing weekly action roundups that are worth checking out. Here's some recent notable actions from the past week and beyond. On March 18th, there was a blockade of a Line 3 pump station. Lockdowns against machinery also stopped construction. In Portland, there was a militant march on a Chase Bank location, one of the banks involved with funding the Line 3 project. Clashes broke out and graffiti slogans were written. Across the U.S., groups also protested outside of various banks demanding divestment from Line 3. In so-called Vancouver, British Columbia, people also blockaded railroad tracks in solidarity with the struggle against the pipeline. Meanwhile, in anti-fascist news, in New York, a coalition of anti-fascist and anarchist groups held an anti-fascist and anti-racist block party last weekend, featuring music, speakers, and presentations on local struggles. Here's our friend, Daryl Lamont Jenkins, addressing the crowd.
How y'all doing? How y'all feeling? That's the important one, how y'all feeling. Because it's a good day, it's the first day of the spring, it's the equinox. We all survived the winter amongst everything else that has gone down over the past 4 years. And I'm gonna tell y'all something. This is the important thing for everybody here. There's a lot of people out there that have survived as well. And it is due to all the work that we all have been doing over the past 4 years. So y'all need to give yourselves a round of applause. When things started happening after Trump got elected,
thank you so much.
We hit the ground running. We took it on. Proud Boys weren't saying F Democrats and F Liberals. They're saying F Antifa because we're the ones that caused them grief.
In Sandy, Oregon, the Proud Boys rallied in support of a local church who had called for a celebration of natural heterosexual families, while pro-LGBTQ groups and community members held a counter-rally across the street. Across North America, people also rallied in the thousands against anti-Asian attacks such as the one carried out in Atlanta, Georgia.
I want y'all to understand why we're here in this location today. About 150 years ago, where you're standing, and from about 15th to 20th, and from Market to Wazee, this used to be Chinatown. What is now labeled as Lodo used to contain much of where Chinatown used to be. On October 31, 1880, another victim of an Asian hate crime perpetuated by white men was denied that right to go home, just like the victims we're here to honor tonight. Luke Young. Luke Young was lynched by a white mob of 3,000 violent white men on the corner of 19th and Arapaho. He was lynched on a light post while they shouted, "Stomp out the yellow plague." For those who don't know that history, it's not a fucking coincidence. Just like it's not a fucking coincidence that before we even knew the victims' names from Atlanta, we knew that the man who committed that hate crime came from a good Christian background and had a fucking youth pastor for a father. Things I couldn't fucking care less about. It's not a fucking coincidence because we all know about the inception of this country. The atrocities that this country has committed in the name of upholding the white supremacy. White supremacy that has woven so fucking deep into the fabric of this country. You can see it so clearly when you see this killer in the back of a cop car without restraints. You can see it when you see Elijah McClain's killer still walking free. You can see it in the inherently racist and so fucking cruel politics that Mayor Hancock puts down upon our homeless communities, that displaces black and indigenous folks at the highest rate. You can see it when you go to Aurora and you see ICE locking up our immigrant population and putting these young children in fucking cages. And when you can see that, you can see that this massacre in Atlanta was no coincidence at all. It's just this country operating as it always has. And when you can see that all of our problems are so intersectional, I hope you can also understand that there is no quick solution like we all want, but the light at the end of the tunnel is that there is a solution.
People across Mississippi and in cities like Jackson have been without water for over a month now, following winter storms knocking out failing and dilapidated infrastructure. In response, autonomous anti-capitalist groups such as Cooperation Jackson have been involved in mutual aid water distribution efforts. To find out more information and how you can support them, check our show notes for links. Autonomous Comrades protests outside of ICE and Adelanto against the continued imprisonment of individuals and families. And in Portland, Oregon and Los Angeles, people threw down in the streets against police on the one-year anniversary of Breonna Taylor's murder, clashing with law enforcement and throwing projectiles. A struggle by residents and supporters of the Near North encampment in so-called Minneapolis has been escalating in recent weeks, as people have been actively resisting attempts by police to evict them. Last week, people blockaded major intersections in response to a brutal yet ultimately unsuccessful police raid and attack on the Near North encampment as authorities attempted to evict local residents.
Near North has been around since October, and they've, you know, built some incredible infrastructure to be able to keep warm from the elements. We just went through a polar vortex. They managed to get through that just fine, and then the state wanted to come through and disrupt what they, the community they built. So, you know, the community defenders weren't having that, and then, you know, it escalated, and, you know, Madaria Arredondo, the Minneapolis Police Department chief, went on a press conference and, you know, tried to, oh, the community, I was appalled by seeing the community members attack my officers, and it was like, you know, well, videos clearly show that it was the opposite. You know, it was the community members that were inquiring about why the police were showing up to evict the encampment in the first place, and we were met with tear gas and total indifference to our questions. People got brutalized, and I don't know, man. It's a lot of gaslighting from our public officials and our politicians, our local ones, and nothing's getting done about this houseless problem. And it comes down to, it's a lot of band-aids being slapped on wounds, but it's a surgical process that needs to start. They're framing it as there's like environmental hazards that prevents them from being able to live in that area that they've occupied. But also like they keep naming off the open beds and shelters. First of all, it's an inaccurate number most time when they throw out these numbers. Second of all, there was a resident who is actually a spokesperson for Near North. And they said, when we get to these shelters, they have us under their thumb. I'd rather risk hypothermia than going in there and dealing with the shelters than getting a bed at the shelter. So that's a lot of, yeah, they're giving out that narrative that the shelter beds are open. It's like, well, dude, no one wants to sit through the winter anywhere in any city, let alone the polar vortex in Minnesota. So when they say, oh, there's shelter beds open, you know, people just choose to be homeless. And I hear a lot of people that parrot that narrative. And it's like, it's sad to just think people are like, just simple-minded to believe that people want to be outside. There's not a deeper problem than that, you know?
In Berkeley, California, tenants held a rally against attempts by UC Berkeley to evict tenants from 1921 Walnut Street. Resistance to UC Berkeley's attempts to bulldoze and evict those at People's Park have also continued as people continue to occupy the park. Also, according to Daily Cal, a local newspaper in the Berkeley area, between the evening of March 4th and the early morning of March 5th, there were between 7 reports of vandalism at private homes of UC Berkeley employees and officials, which are believed to be connected to the pending development of People's Park. The alleged vandals slashed tires and broke vehicle windows, threw a brick in the window of a residence, and spray-painted, quote, highly threatening and hateful graffiti, according to a statement from the campus. From one member of the campus administration, the vandalism stated, "You try it, we riot," the spokesman said. They added that the people were called murderers and other disgusting language, much of which they could not relay, stating that those affected were deeply concerned. A communique posted to IndieBay.org, which seemed to take credit for the vandalism, stated, "We want more than to simply end state and private terror against our houseless friends. Eradicating displacement, gentrification, and those other buzzwords won't satisfy us. The administration at UC Berkeley and the city are prophets of a liberal, high-tech, ruthlessly policed capitalist society that is already killing us and our planet. We want to rip out every rose of the flower beds of their planned society and make their and every one of their cronies' lives and jobs miserable." If you're looking to show solidarity with people in need, Lauren Reed is in need of donations and letters. Also, as previously stated, Cooperation Jackson needs help in their mutual aid work in response to the recent storms across Mississippi. See our show notes for ways to donate. And now for some upcoming events. On Sunday, March 28th, in Union Square, New York, there's a rally in celebration in solidarity with the Rojavan Revolution. On the same day, at George Floyd Square in Minneapolis, there's a How to Fight Repression 101 teach-in. On the same day, in Salem, Oregon, there's a rally against the far right. On Saturday, April 3rd, in Auburn, Indiana, there's a rally and mobilization against the Ku Klux Klan. You can see our show notes for more information on all those events. And finally, if you value It's Going Down as an autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you have the means, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation through the site or on Bitcoin. Again, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to help us continue into 2021. You can also listen to us on the radio, tell a friend about us, follow us on social media, and check out other shows on the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Thanks for listening. Let's dive into it.
I'm so used to feeling All right. So this week on the show, we're going to be sort of taking a bit of a diversion from what we normally speak about. Usually on the show, we're talking a lot about sort of politics and metapolitics and economics and questions of philosophy and theory and things like that. But recently, some of the people that work on this project experienced a really significant loss, where a close friend and collaborator and a confidant for many of us recently committed suicide. And it kind of started a conversation internally about what is going on in our communities right now. Because after a year of lockdown, after a year of not being able to see our friends or go to shows or be outside, even in a lot of cases, after what was a very hard winter for a lot of people, after all of the political crisis that for many of us felt life-threatening, and after an uprising, which for many of us was very hopeful, but has since sort of abated, there are a lot of questions that are sort of arising in our communities related to a lot of people feeling depressed or listless or unfocused or sort of incapable of really even identifying what feels off, right? Or what feels wrong. In a lot of cases that I know of, that's exacerbating underlying behavioral health issues with a lot of people. And when we're all experiencing this together, it becomes really difficult to start to think about what community care looks like. And so tonight, what we're going to do is instead of talking about political theory or economics or something like that, as we tend to do, we're going to dedicate this entire episode to our friend. And we're going to dedicate it to a conversation about community mental health support and ways that we can support each other in times which feel really desperate and in times in which many of us feel really lost and without direction. And so we have a couple of friends on tonight who have a lot of experience dealing with questions like this and have a lot of expertise in those areas. And so tonight we're going to actually give a lot of the time and space of the show to them, to let them sort of talk about what's going on as we sort of move forward. So I guess without further ado, we should just sort of jump into it.
We have returning to the program somebody that's been on several times talking about the topics of suicide and the rising suicide crisis, and also somebody that's involved in peer support, setting up autonomous peer-to-peer support groups, which is going to be one of the things we'll be talking about tonight.
A lot of what we're going to be talking about tonight has to do with our communities and with our lives and with the people around us. And so I think we want to start this conversation off with what to some people might feel like a question which already has an answer, but to many, it doesn't. To many, we get lost in our daily political practice and we lose sight of things like this. And so we wanted to start off by sort of having a discussion or letting our guests sort of discuss what the role of community care work is within structures of community self-defense or within structures of anarchist communities. And what does that look like as part of our daily political practice?
I'm happy to talk a little bit about community care work. I'm Alice, and I think it's important to talk about how we have sort of come to community care work and like come to understand our own sort of like mental health experience, because I think a lot of what the medical like clinical model does is make people feel a lot of shame around their mental health experience. And shame silences people, and our secrets make us sick. And so I'm, you know, I think that there's power in talking about like how we've come to understand ourselves and our mental health experience. And I identify as a mad person, a part of the Mad Pride movement. And I'm a person with psychiatric, you know, my own psychiatric labels. Some have been, most of them have been given to me by, the psychiatric industrial complex. And I'm, you know, I'm also somebody that like many of us struggle with like pretty chronic, suicidal ideation. And I think that that's, I say that, not to center this discussion around me, but because I think that there is, importance in telling our stories and our lived expertise, which we'll talk about more, is really important in the way that we, support one another, and has a lot of validity to it. So, you know, that said, I think, you know, the way I would define community care work and community healing is really like rightfully under the umbrella of community defense, because taking care of one another and supporting one another when things are really, really miserable, one, it should not just fall on like one or two people because that burns folks out. It should be something that we're all involved in as a community and all invested in, so that we can continue to do the work, to create the world that we want, because the world that we currently live in was not created with all of us in mind. And it's killing us. It's hurting us. It's making us sick. And so for me, and I'm, maybe others might disagree, and that's fine. But I think community care work is part of community defense. Community healing is something that we should, you know, we should all have our hands in, that we should all be invested in and have at least a foundation for how to support one another, have some preparation, in terms of how to, how to handle like mental health crises, understand what it means for people to experience like, extreme states or altered states, understand what, you know, what we have a plan in place for how to support people who are like, who are getting tunnel vision and feeling like their options are, the walls are closing in and the options are becoming less and less. Because when we all work together to support one another, like that's how we survive. And that's how we would survive with any other threat. And threats to our mental health are just as valid and important as addressing from a community standpoint as any other threat. So that's sort of my little like 101 for community care.
So I think the question that sort of arises, at that point is, I mean, I think a lot of us know that, radical communities are populated by many people who, exist with psychological states that are, considered quote abnormal, right? Or that we are, you know, people who struggle with things like anxiety or trauma, right? Many of us, the political work that we do is traumatic. Incredibly traumatic for a lot of us. What are ways that, and I think that this is a thing that I struggle with a lot personally, but what are ways in that, in which communities which require mutual support, in which we have to support one another, in which, unlike in the sort of clinical industry, where there's sort of this assumption of the outside kind of analyst, right? The therapist sitting out there in this sort of state of somewhat perfection. How do we start to reconceive of what all of this looks like as communities of people working together, as opposed to sort of structuring that through this kind of hierarchical model of normality that we're so used to hearing?
We're conditioned to experience mental health treatment, from a place of like needing to like give up all of our autonomy and agency. You know, it sets us up to be either forced or coerced into, you know, treatments and things that we don't, may not be helpful. And certainly like there are people who benefit from, traditional mental health services. Part of this, you know, like things that you'd find in the psychiatric or mental health industrial complex. But there's also this other thing called peer support. And peer support is based on mutuality. It's based on lived experience. It's based on worldview. And it's based on like a desire to understand rather than diagnose, right? So For me, peer support has been about connecting with people who can empathize because they've been in similar situations, or experienced similar feelings.
Yeah, the first thing that popped into my mind was what you were just getting into. I was just thinking of the magic, really, I feel like, of just the difference between, like, I've had experiences going to a psychologist who are pretty patronizing and demeaning. And that's like at the best, like a lot of us have had, trauma in psychiatric care, psychiatric survivors. So even just going into that system can be traumatizing or re-traumatizing. And there's such a magic in like how that we can support each other, and that we can relate to each other. Like that's such a huge thing for me, personally, just in my own experience, being able to be in a space where I generally feel like I'm going to feel like a sense that I'm understood, like that I'm heard, that people can relate. Like just that alone some days can really save my sanity. Like that can be so huge.
I completely agree. I think peer spaces are much safer. They're, you know, the threat of force or coercion is like almost like non-existent, I would say. But I also think that many of us come to peer support after we've been harmed by the mental health system. So, there's always sort of that sort of like lingering fear. But I will say that I've been you know, in and out of the mental health industrial complex my whole life. And the ways that I have benefited and been able to thrive, have always existed in peer support spaces. And even at a time when I didn't necessarily know that what I was receiving was peer support, because nobody was trying to fix me or like label my experience. It was more about, hey, what you're experiencing is like valid. It's a totally understandable response to a really fucked up world. And I think that's like that validation is, it's healing. And it's certainly, you know, it's certainly not something that you will find in a traditional mental health setting. And it's nice. Like, I think that people should have options. I think, you know, if folks feel like what they want to do is go into hospital, that's understandable. And I get it. Like if you don't have anywhere to go for the night and it's about to be freezing cold, your best option for survival might be to go into a hospital. But if you have a community of people who are willing to help you out and we can lay the groundwork and put in like the infrastructure to be able to support one another, the best outcomes will come from peer support spaces. I believe.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing, you know, earlier was said by somebody that, you know, a lot of people within radical spaces have histories of dealing with these issues. You know, I just want to point out again, like as we talked about on a previous episode, I mean, right now for young people ages 15 to 24, suicide is the second leading cause of death in the United States, the first being motor vehicle accidents. So I think that like young people, Zoomers and millennials, probably a lot of the people that are listening to this show, you know, we're coming from a generation that's just like, you know, decades and decades and generations of a lot of trauma and a lot of bad stuff happening and just like living in a time of, you know, recession after recession, endless wars, pandemics. You know, right now we're editing a story about, you know, everything that people were doing in Texas when the power went off for several days and people were finding people frozen to death in their beds. I mean, you know, we're living in an unprecedented time. And I think it's true that, like, people in different movements are facing, I think, stuff on top of that. But I think that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, like, a lot of young people right now are just, like, really going through it. And, I mean, that shows in the numbers and the data, and I think it shows in just people's everyday lived experiences. And the only thing I would point out is that, you know, I notice more and more that, like, people that are involved in social movements are dealing much more with, you know, really intense things. And, you know, we should be really aware of that, whether it's people going across the world to fight ISIS or, you know, having to deal with things like grand juries or just, you know, living under a president that says they're going to make opposing fascism into a domestic terrorist category. I mean, all that stuff will put stress on your life and take years off your existence for sure. And I think that, you know, we should be well aware of that. And like people have already been saying, and we need to incorporate movement care into our work. And, you know, we can't just brush this aside.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the really important conversations to have right now, and I would love to hear all your thoughts on this, but, you know, the people that are recording this show, I think, if not all of us, many of us have experienced really solid community support, right? Like, I know myself right now, I'm making it through this situation because I'm surrounded by a lot of people that really care and that are checking in on me. And that's really, really important. But I think right now, especially with a lot of newer people that have entered radical communities over the last 4 or 5 years, with the isolation of lockdown, with the reality that, people's political investments and political identities are not, you know, as for many of us, we were younger, formed on interpersonal relationships, right? And relationships of trust with people that we knew. A lot of the time, people are sort of taking on political identities or taking on political practice, almost in a personal bubble, right? Like they're learning about these things on the internet. They're discussing these things on the internet. They're sort of making sense of these things themselves. And then they're showing up in person and trying to do something, but they're not necessarily tied to a community, right? And so I think the big question that I would love to hear your thoughts on, is what do models of peer support and community support look like, in general, right? So what are some of the models that you all have seen function, from simple to complex, right? And what do those look like right now? I mean, we've got another 5 or 6 months of lockdown probably before we can go back to living our lives in some semblance of normality. And so at least. And so what does that all look like, in the moment?
I can talk about, the peer support work that I've been co-organizing and participating in, and what it looks like now. And yeah, that's a good question, thinking about for the future too. Right now, a lot of us are gathering on video conferences, and we're using one that is a little bit more secure encryption-wise, but it doesn't have a lot of accessibility features. Like, these are all really important considerations with doing, like, this type of work online, remotely. And it's also, like, been, and it's so important, and we're looking at this for, like, the future, too. In my area where I'm at, we used to have in-person meetings, and we had stopped those even before the pandemic, just because low capacity. And but we're talking about coming back eventually together in person at some point, but also maybe keeping the online meetings as well for accessibility too. A lot of us can't always make it out of the house. So that's like, that's really practical stuff. I don't know if that's what, that's where I was going with it. And I have some experience with care pods. I guess I would say I have like an informal care pod currently. But I've seen more formal care pods and how like helpful and supportive those can be as well. But yeah, those are just a couple that I have experience with.
I would say, okay, so last summer, I provided one-on-one, like telephonic peer support to people. I'm a huge fan of care pods, and actually I think like group setting peer support, whether it's over, you know, like it exists in digital spaces or in real life spaces, is an excellent option. And I think in a lot of ways, it's preferable to one-on-one peer support. My background is in providing one-on-one peer support. So, I would, you know, just check in with comrades weekly. You know, what that looks like is, you know, how are you feeling right now? Are there any updates to speak of in terms of like what you're going through? Where are things like where are things like sitting in your body? Like when I talk a lot about like, or I ask a lot of questions about like, if you're feeling this thing, how is it showing up? Where is it? Where, you know, because I think it helps to be a little, be able to like identify some of those things, because I think a lot of times we feel really out of control. But when we're able to like identify where our pain is or our discomfort is, it can help us feel like we have just a little bit more control over our situation. And then address basic needs. Think about bigger, you know, bigger, broader needs. Certainly I'm a part of, I have my own care pod. I don't know that we would call it that, but that's exactly what it is. Care pods are really important because I think it takes, not everybody has the capacity to sit with people in their pain all the time when we may necessarily need it. And, I know for myself, I have needed a lot of support over the last 6 months, and being a part of a group of people, who are checking in, it leaves it open to people to be able to support in whatever way they can. And maybe others like can't at that moment or whatever. So, it's really, you know, I think about like creating networks and building trust and sharing the responsibility of providing support, sort of like, you know, to whatever capacity people can, so that it doesn't just fall on like one or two people. Because when we like, put people in care roles, we know that typically ends up being, primarily like women identifying people, or femmes, taking up those roles. And that can cause, I mean, it can lead to burnout. It can lead to all kinds of things. And really, community should be sharing the roles of support, amongst each other. Because that's, you know, that it's really important and it's really valuable, I think, for people to be able to receive different kinds of support from different people. Yeah, I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the biggest barriers I've experienced in my life in communities I've been in is a perception that I've heard people articulate that they're too broken to be able to support people. Right. Or that they're, too abnormal. And a lot of this seems to really come heavily from, sort of clinical psychology, right? And sort of the assumptions of normality in clinical psychology and the way that, quote, abnormality is demonized. And I think one of the questions that I would love for you to kind of like dive into a bit is, how do we start to, both make sense of and transcend that sort of narrative of brokenness, right? How do we start to really think of ourselves as people that are capable of providing support to each other, even if we don't feel okay ourselves sometimes, right? And what does that all look like as far as sort of breaking that down and shifting the ways that we're thinking about our own mental health and the way that that relates to other people around us?
The idea of being too broken to do something is ableist and sanist. And, that comes just straight out of capitalism, right? Being too broken to produce whatever, you know, like whatever amount of money for whatever entities are wanting us to. Before I got involved in the Mad Pride movement, I sort of also I really felt that way too. Like, how am I supposed to help people when I'm so fucked up myself? But learning more about Mad Pride and about the Mad Pride movement and the, psychiatric survivors movement really helped me reframe the way I see my mental health experience, and the symptomology that goes with sort of whatever psychiatric labels I've been given. And I've been able to reframe, my symptoms and struggles as gifts. And I know that sounds a little crunchy, but I don't know that this is true for everybody, but, when I'm feeling anxious, that means that something around me is amiss, and I can tap into that and figure out what it is. And some people don't feel that the way I feel that, and maybe struggle to engage with the world because they're not so tapped into it or whatever. I know that when I'm feeling especially suicidal, I know that that comes from a place of feeling trapped. And so I can check in with myself and my environment about what it means to, exercise a little bit more agency and autonomy, and what is it about my situation currently that makes me feel trapped. And before I got involved in peer support and Mad Pride, I didn't know that. I couldn't see these things in through that lens, of strength. And I'm grateful to the movement for having shown me that, because I feel like the way I engage with my mental health, is so much more powerful now. And I can I enjoy helping others sort of navigate their experiences that way as well. And I mean, certainly there are aspects of our mental health experiences that are really, really painful. And I would never discredit that. And some things just fucking suck. Some days it's just really hard to get out of bed. And I think that we can see that as maybe a message that we're getting, and maybe to check in with ourselves about something that we need that we're not getting. Because we deserve to do that. Because if we're not doing that, if we're just continuing to grind and grind and grind, and our bodies and our minds are telling us that something is wrong, but we're ignoring it, we will destroy ourselves. We will burn out. And if we burn out, we're not able to keep working to build this better world. I guess that's sort of that's sort of the way I see it.
I do want to name that, relationships can be hard. doing this more one-on-one, it is super, it can be very vulnerable. It can be a challenge for those of us who have survived a lot of trauma at the other hands of other people. It can be hard. It can be so hard to open up and let people in and build that trust with people. Going back into organizing radical mental health, peer support stuff when the pandemic started, I really I was reminding myself, this is about building relationship, and relationship takes time. It takes time to build trust with each other and get to know each other and get to know each other's boundaries and each other's needs. And it is a lot more the capitalist model is so inhumane, and I think it's trained so many of us to be comfortable in that kind of space in a way, like we're not, like it can be a lot more vulnerable, like the one-on-one space. I don't know if that makes sense. And like taking those risks with each other can be so, so beautiful too.
Yeah. Well, and I definitely want to spend a good amount of time in this episode sort of talking about crisis response, right? And sort of prior to recording, we were sort of talking a bit about that. But before we get there, this most recent conversation is really bringing up a point that I think is really important to kind of parse through, which is that, as you both named, it's hard to trust people sometimes, right? And I think a lot of us that have been around in the scene for a long time and have experienced repression and have experienced informants and have experienced infiltration and things like that, I know that it's had this effect on me. It is very difficult for me to trust people at certain points in my life, almost impossible. And so how do you both think that trust can be built in contexts like that? Like what are some of the introductory mechanisms that people can sort of use to even approach the idea of being able to trust other people or be able to build trust with other people? Whether they know them or not, right? Whether it's just a friend that you might not necessarily trust with your, you know, deepest, most inner emotions, or whether it's a stranger. How do we start to transcend the effects of the world and how that's generated a really profound sense of mistrust in a lot of us?
With a lot of patience and grace, I think, from just like a, from an offset perspective, a vouch goes a long way. But even more than that, I mean, so starting small, right? Start, if you want to create a community of connectedness, who can like be there for each other, starting with the people that you know, that you do trust, and sort of building from there, right? Like, folks don't have to go out and try and recruit 15 people for a group right away. That's like unrealistic and probably a little dangerous. But I think, you know, through word of mouth and experience, you know, if people have a good experience in like a group that you sort of like even an informal group that you have, and want to invite another person in, I think, you know, there's some safety in that. You know, like vetting is, I don't think, right, there's like no hard and fast rules for this, because I think peer support groups are autonomous, and each group has its own sort of set of like guidelines that it operates under or by or whatever. And so what works for one group may be entirely different than what works for another group. And also, you know, you can sort of form these peer supportive relationships and not have to disclose any personally identifying information. And in fact, that might feel safest to people initially, and it might feel safest for people continually. That, you know, just like checking in and talking about like the things that you're feeling, it doesn't necessarily require us to disclose like personally identifying information. But I would love to hear what other ideas folks have.
I think there are activities that we can use to build trust with each other. You know, this is where I think a lot of things like, you know, mutual aid organizing or, you know, just basic base building comes into. I mean, this allows people to fill people out and, you know, gain trust that way.
There are a couple of things that this brings to mind. This sort of like digital connectedness thing, conversation. I think, you know, in many ways, right, like connecting in digital spaces can be harmful. And we are all you know, acutely aware of how badly things can go awry online. And I want to counter that by saying that, like, you know, being able to connect in digital spaces has done wonders for folks who have trouble accessing, like, IRL support for whatever reason. Either maybe they live in a remote area, or they don't have access to community, or maybe they have a disability that prevents them from meeting up with people in real life. And so I think that, you know, that there is some validity to connecting in digital spaces for folks that struggle to access, you know, in real life support. And a couple of years ago, there was a study that came out about actually young men being able to receive what we would call peer support, just from, like, chatting in like video game chat rooms. So I'm not a gamer, so forgive my vernacular. But you know, it's because of like toxic masculinity, it can be hard for men to talk about what they're experiencing. But this study found that men and boys were able to connect more organically and authentically while also, like, gaming together. And I think that there's something about that that's really wonderful, that, like, it was an unintended consequence of a gaming community, right? And so I think there's pros and cons to both.
For sure. I mean, I know one of the things that I've had a hard time with in the past is, as someone mentioned, being able to trust newer, younger people, right? Having gone through whatever any of us have gone through, and watching people be what feels like reckless, online, right? Broadcasting their stuff out everywhere. But it points to this generational divide as was mentioned. And I guess one of the more difficult, dynamics I've seen emerge, as a result of that generational divide has been this kind of fragmentation of some of our communities, where, I know where I live, we experience this, where there's whole groups of younger people that, we're tangentially connected to, but in reality sort of operate entirely on their own. We're not really in close communication with them at all. We sort of see them at stuff when things arise, but, if support was needed in those kinds of contexts, what are some ways that those of us that have been around for a little bit longer and have had some of these experiences, what are some of the ways that we can reach out to younger people that we notice might need support, or that might be sort of running through a cycle of burnout and not necessarily knowing it, or even just to reach out to offer the ability to be there to support them if they need it? What are some ways that can be done safely, or that we can navigate that distance, I guess?
I would say that reaching out from a place of how can I help versus I'm noticing you're doing something that's a little sketchy or whatever. I think people tend to respond better when you're willing to come and offer something, and then, like, you can kind of build from there, right? So, if you feel like you have some insight into something, being willing to offer some help with something that they identify that they need, and then going, you know, building on that relationship, and also, like, it's hard because people are mistrusting, and I think folks that have been doing this work for a while have a different sort of worldview, I think, and that can clash with younger folks who are learning as they go currently, and maybe don't have the experience.
I feel like older folks that I've met are very quick to write off younger folks because oftentimes they're like scared to get denounced. It's kind of like the older, like stick in the muds. Like, you know, in my day we would have done, shut up, you know, like no one wants to like be in that spot of getting like denounced by newer folks. But I think that older folks really have to, reach out across the aisle and like talk to newer people. And I think newer people also have to, attempt to kind of do the same, to like be in a position to like receive, guidance, advice, and, you know, take that for what it is. Not saying that you have to necessarily listen to it, but like take that into account for what's going on. Cause I think we need all of it. We need like both people's, experience, and we also need, you know, newer people's insight into what's going on.
This is as good a time as any to sort of pivot a bit in the conversation. So I think a lot of what we've been talking about is, ways that we can support each other in, a variety of circumstances, but in a kind of consistent or persistent way, or like being able to offer that. But what does this look like in situations of crisis? So I know myself, I've been that phone call before for friends, where they're experiencing an acute crisis in that exact moment. And something has like things have to be done in the immediate sense to help address that. What are ways that we can sort of think through crisis and think through crisis response? What are some of the sort of problems with the way that that's thought about now, especially as it relates to things like coping mechanisms or the way that we think about suicide, things like this? And how do we start to sort of think about crisis response in a way which sort of embodies the type of community that we want rather than the world that we have currently?
Well, I'm happy to address this from the experience that I have. So I think, my sort of rule is like, I guess it's not even a rule. If I have comrades, when I have had comrades that have expressed to me that they are feeling suicidal, my immediate response is to thank them for trusting me. I think like that's a really practical, meaningful, validating response, is like, hey, thank you so much for trusting me. I can tell things are really painful right now. You know, just because somebody is feeling suicidal doesn't mean that they're going to act on it. And, you know, I think like the reality is that, some people may choose to act on it. And part of being, you know, part of being, believing in autonomy and agency is getting comfortable with that very uncomfortable, reality, the very tragic reality that people like can and will die by suicide if that is what they want. Now, there are things that we can do to help mitigate some of that. And I have, you know, when I've been feeling really scared for my own safety, I've crashed on the couches of comrades, and I've talked about means restriction. And what that means is having some really honest conversations about, okay, if you're, you know, if you're feeling suicidal, how would you, you know, how would you do it? How are you planning on doing it? Have you thought about planning on doing it? And like, what would you use? And so maybe that means, taking a firearm, like packing up a firearm for somebody and keeping it while they're in crisis. Or, you know, if they have, you know, if they're like sort of thinking about taking pills or whatever, talking about having really honest, direct dialogue about what that is and how much they want, your comrade wants you to be involved in means restriction, if that is a thing that will help them feel safer. Because, you know, a lot of this hinges on what's going to keep our comrades most comfortable during a really painful, high intensity moment. And then I also think, you know, talking about coping skills is really important. And so when I say coping skills, I do not mean, this includes like, you know, deep breathing and doing, you know, doing whatever sort of mental exercise your therapist has given you, or maybe you learned online, or maybe you got from like, a handout or something like that. Those are great. Those are great coping skills, or like yoga, or, you know, going for a walk. Those are great. But I'm, when I say coping skills, I'm referring to things like self-harm and substance use. Because those are the things that, even though they are uncomfortable to talk about, that those might be the things that are keeping our comrades alive. Getting drunk or using, you know, using a substance, that might be the thing that helps, a comrade that's experiencing a lot of mental anguish make it through the night and be around for us the next morning. And same with other forms of self-harm. And certainly self-harm can be the things that like come to mind when we think of self-harm, or self-harm can also include things like, you know, like there's a medical term like undignified risk taking. So any risk taking that you wouldn't like win an award for. So that could be like driving really fast, or, you know, maybe like putting yourself at risk in some other ways. And, you know, that's like all of these things can be considered coping skills. And so talking with our comrades about, okay, what's it going to take to help us get through this like really awful moment right now, this really painful moment? And what can I do to be here for you? And do you need a place to stay tonight? And like, if you, this is why I think like the care pods are really important, right? Because it allows many of us to support a person in crisis together, as opposed to that, to it being just like one person or maybe even like two people. Does that make sense? And I mean, so the other thing is like when we're talking about, things like self-harm, we can also talk about harm reduction. And so if somebody, you know, if somebody we know is really, really struggling and they're in a mental health crisis and they don't want to go, like a hospital is not an option. And maybe what they're used to doing is like cutting. Then we can talk about really practical ways, to apply harm reduction. Like, are you using clean tools? Do you have a first aid, like a first aid kit? How do you know when you've gone too far or when it's an emergency? And what do we do when we've gotten to that point? And the thing with crisis is like, if you ask direct questions, you'll get direct answers. And I know that that can be so uncomfortable, but those are the things that are life-saving. So I think it really matters that we're able to do that and be comfortable, you know, sitting with each other while we're in pain and not feeling like we have to fix everything. We can take the burden off ourselves to be the fixer. Like, that's not our role, right? But our role can be supportive, and that's different. Being supportive is different than fixing. I hope I like touched on your question.
No, that was wonderful. I think one of the hurdles that I know, I've been trying to work through for many years, right? And you touched on this, in your response, but, the discomfort, right? Like, I think we're used to models of friendship, which are, clean and smooth, right? Generally non-conflictual, fun. Right. Things like that. I mean, that's what we're sort of fed. That's what we're socialized to think of as friendship or relationships. How do we start to get comfortable with discomfort? Right. So how are there ways that we can start to acclimate ourselves essentially to, being able to hear or say things which are really difficult? Things which might make you worried that people are going to think differently about you, or, that you might worry that you're revealing too much about yourself, right? Or that, you just don't want to share for whatever reason, right? Or you don't want to hear for whatever reason. How do we start to develop the ability to really say and hear those things in the ways that we need to?
I mean, I think it takes, some like introspection, right? You know, I have lived in a household where, you know, certain members of the household didn't ask questions we didn't want to know the answers to. So we just avoided it. But I think radical honesty is really, really important. And we sit in our own pain all the time. So, you know, it's a matter of reframing, but it's not easy. And I don't want to, I don't want to reduce it to something that's simple, because it's not simple. It takes some time and it takes a lot of trust to be able to sit with each other. And decentering our own feelings when someone else is sharing what they're experiencing, right? So we might have a lot of feelings that that are coming up for us as we're hearing that someone we care about is experiencing a lot of pain. And that makes sense. And let's table what we're feeling for a moment and just center the person who is going through the crisis. And then we can circle back and work through our stuff with others in our supportive community, right? Cause this shouldn't just be like all on one or two people. This should be a community, a community thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, most definitely. I think we've a few times the idea of, community support falling on one or two people has come up a number of times, and that's definitely something I've seen more times than not, unfortunately. And I think it really raises a number of questions about how we can start to do all of this better. I think that and I've talked with, I often talk about being from the Rust Belt and what Rust Belt anarchism looked like and has looked like and does look like, how it is built really on a narrative of dispossession, right? And a narrative of violence and experiencing a lot of violence and experiencing a lot of tragedy. And that work often falls onto a few people, right? That in that community, we failed for a lot of years to talk about our trauma, at all. We just sort of, rolled from one thing to another for years and years and years. And that whole time we were getting beaten down by police and, experiencing really intense conflict and being arrested and put in jail and dealing with repression and all of that, and never talked about it, ever. And I know a lot of people from that community now, finally in our mid to late 30s, are starting to process all of that out. And so it really raises this question about what we can do differently or what we can do better, ways that we can prevent the pace of events from taking over and stopping us from taking the time to identify how we're feeling and supporting each other, ways that we can restructure the way that we think of networks so it doesn't all fall on a couple of people. And so I think the primary question that I think forms the foundation of a lot of this discussion is something that has to do with the way that we prioritize political work in our lives and what we consider to be political work. That one of the things that happened during that period of time is that there was a tacit assertion that we would just deal with it later because what we were dealing with at the moment was really, really important. And that was the wrong way to think about it. But it's a perception that I find very common, especially in moments of extreme political conflict like we went through in the last year. So what are some ways that we can sort of realign our thinking around that, ways that we can start to really think about this kind of work as part of what we're doing rather than separate from what we're doing, that we can prioritize these things in our lives? And I think really importantly, how can we start to build these sort of practices into our communities to prevent it all from falling onto the heads of a couple of people that ultimately will end up being very burned out as a result?
I love that this question is being asked. if we're thinking about the world we want to create, right? I'm thinking of Adrienne Marie Brown and emergent strategies is the first thing that's popping in my mind. What kind of world are we fighting for? Are we, we're not fighting to keep the world where we've all had to continuously suppress all of this and go on living in trauma and not getting to heal, right? Like, that's been white supremacy. Like, we're done with all that. I think it is so important to prioritize that and to, like, prioritize care and, like, prioritize our feelings. Like, it's really, it can be so hard to do that. Like, even in saying that and reflecting on my own day-to-day life, like, it can be really so hard to do that. Like, there's so much in the world that, like, we have to fight against to even just do that. It feels like sometimes, but even just making those seemingly small choices, I think, to prioritize that, like, is so huge, can be so huge.
I would say, like, making it a point to, like, check in with your, you know, your affinity group or whatever, like, regularly. Hey, everybody, how's everyone feeling? Just checking in, you know, taking the temperature of everyone's moods. How's everybody doing? Is anybody in pain? Like, really just, like, creating that space. And it might be awkward at first. And this is just really practical. You know, it might be awkward at first, and people may not be so, like, you know, willing to share, but the more that that becomes a normal part of the way that you're interacting, whether it's in real life or in like a group chat or something like that, the more second nature it will become to speak on things that are painful. And, you know, I think being able to connect and being able to label our experiences is, it's a really great first step in then being able to both receive and give support.
So there's been a couple of things now that I've brought up, like, that I've been thinking about from my personal experience. Like, it's been really helpful for me. Like, the more I've sat with my own pain and my own feelings and my own, all the myriad of things that I go through, the more able I've been, to sit with that discomfort, like, slowly have grown more capacity for that. Like, it does take time. Like, I do want to acknowledge that. And gentleness and patience. And that's enabled me to be more open with people and communicate that stuff with people. And also, that's enabled me, I feel like, to also be there for other people and also to sit with that discomfort like we're talking about. And I don't know, I just, for me, yeah, just that personal, like, taking the time and the space for that in my own self, like, has created capacity to be able to do that with other people. I don't, does that make sense?
yeah, definitely. So what are some ways that people could get started? I mean, I remember way back when, you know, 10 years ago or so, every town I lived in had, like, an Icarus Project chapter, and you could just, like, go to the basement of a church, and there was, like, a group you could just drop into and talk about this stuff with. And that didn't always function super well, and those groups were generally pretty ephemeral, but they did exist, right? And there is sort of a lack of that at the moment. I know that in a lot of places, there's not really any infrastructure built up to do this kind of support. There's not really any structures for people that aren't already connected, right? People like myself or, you know, like a lot of the people that have been involved for a while, we know people, you know, and if we need help, we have people that we can reach out to for that. Increasingly so. I think as we get older, we've been much better about that, but for some people that are sort of disconnected, that can be a little bit difficult. And so for those of us that are already in community, that are already working on things like mutual aid projects all the time and sort of doing community support work and things like that, what are some of the things that people can be doing as part of that to help sort of build the basis for solid community mental health support?
There are some, you know, there certainly if folks are interested in like an actual like training or model, I guess that there are some really good ones out there. The one I would most recommend is intentional peer support. And like, you don't even have to go through their training. You can just like get their workbook, which is a really great workbook. And it's like $35, and you can even get a digital copy that I think is even cheaper. The workbook is really helpful because it like, as you go through it, it gives you, you know, it helps you unpack your own mental health experience and sort of through the lens of, the social model of disability versus like the biomedical model for that sort of like treats mental illness as disorder. And I think that's maybe a really great place to start. If peer support is something that you want to like really get, you know, like get more acquainted with. But I think, you know, some of the most, some of the most life-saving peer support I've ever gotten has been completely informal. It's just a group of us who are invested in staying alive. You know, granting each other grace and creating a space where we can just be like really honest about what we're experiencing. And sort of building from there. I don't think that people need to go out and pay for a training to be able to support one another. We have made it this far. And most of us don't have training. We're just out here just doing the very best we can. And, you know, like granting each other grace and patience and, you know, being empathic. Those are like not trying to like force people to do a thing or putting the responsibility of being a fixer on ourselves. That's not what peer support's about. Peer support is like holding space and like sitting with people. And, so folks don't have to like experience their pain alone. So I think like keeping that in mind and just, you know, doing the best we can to stay connected. Connectedness is really important.
I would say reach out to your, like, if you do have even like a friend or two, like reach out to your friends and like, if you have friends that you know have also go through, these struggles and like, you can share in that together. And like, just like how Alice was saying, like the informal like care, like that's a lot of like, I've been participating in peer support groups, but sometimes I can have a hard time participating in group settings. So I've been trying to connect more one-on-one with people and stay connected and check in with each other. Just doing that. And maybe you'll learn more specific needs that you have too as you go on, that you can ask for support in, which can also be a challenging thing in itself that we get to learn how to do. Just reaching out to friends. And even, I mean, the advice I would give to anybody who's thinking about like starting a peer support group or, you know, even just starting it with your couple friends, basically, like that's your peer support meeting. And then you can go, build from there, just like we've been talking about a lot.
Excellent. Well, does anybody have any final thoughts that they would love to share, before we close out tonight? And I want to thank both of you for being here. It's been, enlightening and wonderful. So thank you very much. Do either of you have any final thoughts that you would like to share?
I think I just want to add that, you know, what we're experiencing right now is really hard, and we're, inundated with tragedy, and, to hold space for ourselves and be gentle with ourselves as we grieve and mourn, and like do the things that like create space to do the things that like feel good and create space to do the things that don't feel good, like cry and be angry. And you know, there's no reason to like do that alone. We can lean on each other, as we grieve, as we move forward. I think, thanks for bringing me on. This is a struggle we're all invested in. So
these are just reminders that I've been receiving from other people around me and that I've been giving to myself, that we're not alone. And we do have gifts from all of this and wisdom from all of this. And that's really valuable. Like, we are valuable.
Well, I want to thank everybody again for coming on tonight. I know this conversation was really important for me, even just as part of my own coping process with what's going on. And I really hope that for those of you that are listening, one of the things that I've always appreciated about being a part of the anarchist community is that it's a community. You don't see that in other political tendencies. You know, you don't see that with people that are part of the Democratic Party. They don't have social support structures like this. But we work together. You know, we have each other's back. We keep each other safe, right? Or we should be. And in our ideal, sort of way of being, we would be, and we are. I want everyone, and, you know, we've mentioned this on the show before, and we just devoted a whole episode to it, but I really want everyone to make sure that they're checking in with themselves, that they're really being honest with themselves about the effects of the things that they've done and the things that they've lived through and the things that they've experienced and how that has impacted them, right? How that has shaped them, what that might bring up for them, and what support they can find. We have to do this work. Revolutionary activity is hard. Life is hard. And the structures that surround us when we're trying to get help are not always helpful. And so oftentimes we have each other. Just like when we're out in the streets together, we have each other. And we really need to embrace that in order to be able to survive this and be able to move forward. So I just really want everyone to just really look at each other and remind each other that we're all valuable, that we're all useful, that we all are unique, and that we all deserve the best that we can have. And then really work with each other to try and make those things possible, try and support each other, try and keep each other standing. So yeah, for those of you doing this work, I really want to thank you for that. It's really hard work. And I'm in awe of the people that do it every day. So thank you very much. And for everyone out there, again, keep each other safe. Hug your friends when you get an opportunity. And realize that we're in this together, because if we're not in this together, we're never going to be able to even function in this world with the way that it is right now.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.